were coming true. My disability was going to ruin my chances with Francesca. I stood up and brushed off the grass clippings, telling myself things couldn't possibly get worse. And that's when things got worse. I looked down and discovered that the foot on my artificial leg was turned backward. Like, it was literally facing the opposite direction of my real foot. I glanced at Francesca. She wasn't laughing anymore. The awkwardness level was off the charts, well beyond the scale of any normal measurement of social discomfort. But at least Francesca knew I had a prosthesis. You can't imagine the horror on the faces of the other golfers as they stared at a leg apparently so severely fractured that the foot was now capable of rotating 180 degrees. The other golfers were undoubtedly whipping out their cell phones to call 911. Hi, 911? I have a serious golfing injury to report. A young man fell down, and when he stood up, his foot was turned backward. I don't know how it's possible either, but I'm telling you, that's how it looks from my angle. Yes, a female companion. No, based on her body language right now, I'd assume they'll never be more than just friends. It's strange to walk in the direction opposite of where one of your feet is pointing. And I imagine it looks even stranger. Still, I managed to hobble over to a tree by the side of the fairway. I started kicking the tree with my artificial leg, trying to pop the foot back into place. When I was too out of breath to continue kicking, I paused to examine my progress. None. Zero. The foot was still facing backward. I needed more leverage. I began kicking again, spinning with full roundhouse kicks so my artificial foot struck the tree at eye level. At this point, I was sure the other golfers were looking at each other and saying, "This guy has some serious anger management problems." I looked down and saw that my foot was finally pointing in the same direction as the rest of my body. That was the good news. The bad news was that I had chopped down the tree. Not literally chopped it down the way loggers do with chainsaws, like timber. It was more like the way smaller trees look after a hurricane has come through and they're all bent parallel to the ground. So, yeah. Definitely left a big carbon footprint that day. Francesca, who was, in retrospect, probably something of a conservationist, and a small group of similarly minded onlookers all just stood there, jaws hanging open in silence, as I walked over to my ball with both feet facing proudly forward and putted it in for a birdie. I pumped my fist and smiled like things were going great, trying to keep up appearances, keep the date alive. Even with this hole in two, though, I knew my chances with Francesca were ruined. The contortions on her face while I was destroying that young sapling had said it all. This is awkward. On the way home, we listened to Ani again. This time, I was connected with her anger. "She is so deep, this Ani DeFranco," I thought. "She sees the world for what it truly is. A cruel, dark place that chews up those who are different and spits them out again." I pulled into Francesca's driveway and parked my car in front of the garage. I didn't bother to turn off the idling engine. This goodbye, I expected, would not last long. "Thanks for coming," I said, breaking the silence. "I had fun," she said. "We should hang out more this summer." I opened my mouth to say "see you later" or whatever I had planned to say before she spoke, but my voice caught when I recognized the tonality of her words. She actually sounded like she wanted to see me again. "Okay, well, yeah. I'll see you soon then." Chapter 13. It was a month into the summer, and I had been coming over to Francesca's house once or twice a week to play pool in her basement. After I beat her, footnote, it's never been clear to me whether you're supposed to let a girl win or not. I went with not. Anyway, after such a game, we'd sit on the porch swing in the backyard and talk. Or I'd take her to Jess's quick lunch downtown. All of which is to say, by the time we went hiking, we were pretty skilled at talking to each other. Which was good, since the drive to the trailhead was longer than I remembered. About 2 hours, or 2.5 on Ida Franco CDs. Hiking down to the base of the falls is pretty easy, because you're doing just that. Hiking down. You park on Skyline Drive in Shenandoah National Park, and then you descend for 4 miles of switchbacks, worrying the whole time about the moment when you will be sitting on that rock, overlooking the waterfall, and you will turn your head sideways and purse your lips and close your eyes and move in for the kill. But if you close your eyes first, how will you know where exactly to move? Maybe you move in first and then close your eyes. And when do you insert your tongue into her mouth? The base of the falls was just how I remembered it from when I went there with my youth group in 8th grade. When I climbed on top of that rock and that guy told me to bring a girl back here someday. Heavily wooded with trees and shrubbery and shadowed by a towering rock face with a backyard pool-sized swimming hole underneath. There was no one else there. It was like our own perfect private oasis in the forest. I had been hoping that Francesca would wear a bikini that day, but she was sporting a modest green and black one-piece. Much more disappointing was that she wouldn't swim in the pool underneath the falls. "It's just too cold," she said. She just stood up to her ankles and watched while I jumped off a low ledge into the water, trying to splash her with irresistible vibes of fun. But she didn't budge. She just smiled and said something about how this all looked like a movie, which made me realize that if this were really a movie, my character would be expected to grab her around the waist and pull her into the water. She would shriek and scream and protest, but deep down she would love it. Then we'd splash each other and giggle like school children, and she'd start trying to dunk me. And then I would fake like I had drowned by breathing through a straw made out of bamboo. And she'd freak out and start crying, and her wrists would hang limp while she flapped her hands. And then I'd pop out of the water and surprise her, and she'd laugh, and then we'd kiss. And maybe that's what she was hoping would happen. After all, why else would she strip down to her swimsuit and stand on the edge of the water like that? I started to swim toward her so I could pull her in, but while I did so, I made the mistake of thinking. Then I stopped and treaded water. I couldn't do it. There was simply too much risk. Risk that she'd be annoyed by the cold water. Risk that she would find me grabbing her around the waist inappropriate. Risk that my balance, standing with one leg on the slick rocks, wouldn't be stable enough to topple her. Risk that it would be awkward. Risk that she didn't like me. I shook my head, wishing I were in a movie instead of in my brain. "What?" she asked. "Nothing." I climbed out of the water and picked up my crutches. I thought about putting my shirt back on, but decided to keep it off in the hope she would be impressed by what I imagined were the chiseled muscles of my 16-year-old chest. This, I would soon discover, was a massive tactical error. But not for the reasons you probably think. "Come on, I want to show you something." We walked in our swimsuits and bare feet up the steep, rooted path. At the top, we came to the rock. And again, I hesitated. Not about kissing her, but about simply sitting down. What if I sat down and she didn't sit beside me? I looked at her. I looked at the rock. No, I couldn't do it. Too big a risk. So I just stood there, surveying the stupid trees below and thinking about how stupid it was that I couldn't even bring myself to take the risk of sitting on a stupid rock and what was wrong with my stupid brain until suddenly she sat down on the rock and looked up at me like I was supposed to join her. I smiled and bit my lower lip. What? She asked. Nothing. I set my crutches down and then sat beside her, beads of water rolling down my back. Phase one was complete. But I wasn't sure how to initiate phase two, the kiss. Maybe I could do so by telling the story of how I first came here 3 years ago. However, since then, I had thought this would be a perfect place for, you know, a first kiss. I came to this rock a few years ago. I've always wanted to come back. Upon its telling, I realized the story was both shorter and less effective than I had hoped. It's a beautiful view, she offered. Yeah. We were silent for a while, listening to the roar of the waterfall. It was the good kind of silent, though. She breathed in slowly through her nose, taking in the scene. And then she said, thoughtfully, "It smells like pot up here." I had absolutely no clue what pot smelled like. "Yeah," I said, sniffing. "It totally does." Then we were quiet again. I decided to try another tactic for initiating phase two, the deep conversation. "Let me ask you something," I said. "Okay. Why do you think adults give up on their dreams?"
I don't know.
"But you know what I'm saying, right? It's like everyone our age wants to change the world or be famous or something, right?" She shrugged.
"Yeah, I guess.
But most adults don't do any of those things. They just sort of live normal lives. But it's like they're okay with that. It doesn't bother them."
I never really thought about it that way.
Why do you think that is? She was quiet for a little bit.
I don't know. I guess people just get busy.
I guess so.
What do you think? She asked.
I didn't know. But I wanted to know. I wanted my life to count. I wanted my dreams to come true.
Yeah, you're probably right. People get busy.
She nodded. I looked out at the treetops and continued speaking with all the heady profundity that comes with knowing so much and understanding so deeply how the world works. They get busy with being married and having children and house payments, and then they're old and they missed out on their dreams.
That's probably it.
Good thing we're still young.
Yeah.
And that we figured that out.
Yeah.
We were both watching the water zip off the edge just below us. You could taste the mist coming off the falls. "I want to change the world," I blurted out.
"You do?"
"Yeah. And I'm going to do it too."
"How?"
"I don't know. But I'm going to." She looked right into my eyes.
"I believe you," she said. "Seriously."
We held each other's gaze. Neither of us said anything. Neither of us moved. Neither of us even blinked. I moved my head forward exactly 1 centimeter. She squinted slightly, questioningly. "This is it," I thought. "It's going to happen. My first kiss. Right now." That's when it hit me. I was wearing a swimsuit. No underwear, no shirt. If I got, you know, excited, which seemed all but certain during my first kiss, it would be about as subtle as a circus tent going up on your next-door neighbor's front lawn. And what would she think? Would she be grossed out and go home and call her friends and tell them about it? Would it be a story that followed me through the halls of high school until graduation?
Well, it's getting kind of late, I said, glancing up at the dimming afternoon sky.
Her body jumped involuntarily, as if startled.
Oh, I guess you're right.
As we hiked all the way back up to the car, I told her about my dream to become a Paralympic skier someday. I had learned to ski right after I lost my leg as a kid, and while I was still on chemotherapy, I met a former coach of the U.S. Paralympic team who told me that I had great potential. Ever since that day, I had wanted to race in the Paralympics. I asked her what her dreams were, and she said she didn't have any. I told her she should get some. Side benefit of dating me? Free motivational speeches. It's like Friends with Benefits, where the benefits are inspirational.
I guess you're right, said Francesca.
Hiking against gravity was significantly slower than hiking with it, as it turned out. The sun set and the trail turned dark under the canopy of a dense pine forest. Interesting, I thought, since we hadn't walked through any dense pine forests on the way down.
I think we lost the trail, I said.
We examined the bed of pine needles under our feet. There was indeed no trail.
This is like something out of a horror movie, she said.
I recognize this as my cue to demonstrate bravery.
Yeah, pretty freaky, I agreed, not bravely at all.
Francesca and I wandered around the woods in the dark, trying to navigate by moonlight and the North Star, something I'd learned how to do in Boy Scouts. By learned, I don't mean I could actually do it, but that I knew enough big words, latitude, equator, compass, south by southwest, etc., to get the orienteering merit badge. Footnote, I'm actually an Eagle Scout, but the only time I ever did orienteering, I got lost and my artificial leg got stuck in some bushes and then it got dark and cold and I had to blow my emergency rescue whistle until the scout leaders came and found me. Unfortunately, I did not bring such a whistle on my date with Francesca. So my only real strategy was to keep us walking in the same direction. As long as you go in a straight line, you'll eventually run into the end of the national park, right? I would later discover that as we wandered, Francesca's dad was calling my house every hour. At one point, Francesca's dad said to my dad on the phone, I just want you to know, even though I'm a little worried right now, there's actually no young man I'd rather have my daughter out with than your son. Oh, great. Thanks. Just what every teenage Ani DeFranco fan wants. A guy who has the enthusiastic endorsement of her father. I'm not sure why parents always liked me when I was growing up. Maybe because I used big words and knew how to do math problems. Maybe they thought cancer made me mature for my age. Maybe because they thought I wouldn't be able to try anything on their daughters since I had a physical disability. Whatever it was, it's safe to say that if girls chose their boyfriends based on who their parents liked, I could have required resumes and headshots from girls before they would even be eligible for consideration. That's how much the parents liked me. But parental approval doesn't do much for you when you're trying to date high school chicks. In fact, it makes it harder. Because deep down, every teenage girl wants to bring home some biker dude with prison tattoos and a tendency to break anything that shatters. Beer bottles, windshields, young girls' hearts. Just so her dad will flip out. Eventually, Francesca and I stumbled out of the pine forest onto a road. There were no cars or people in sight. This really is just like a horror movie, she said again.
Being that in my family, we weren't allowed to watch PG-13 rated movies until we were 16, and R rated movies until we were adults and responsible for our own souls, I had never actually seen a horror movie. Yeah, I said. It totally is. We followed the pavement in a randomly chosen direction for 30 minutes and eventually found the parking lot, empty except for my car, which was sparkling in the moonlight thanks to a trip to the car wash that morning. Chapter 14. About halfway through the summer, I ran into some guys I knew from school. They said they heard Francesca and I had been hanging out. I asked them where they had heard that. They said, around. I took this as good news. One day she called me and we had the following conversation. What are you doing this weekend? She asked. Nothing. What are you doing? You ever heard of Pat McGee? I think so. A singer, right? I said. Uh-huh. His band is having a concert up in D.C. Cool, I said. You going? I really want to, but my parents said I'm not allowed to drive to D.C. Bummer. I know, huge bummer, she said. There was a pause. Now, listener, you will be tempted to think I am making up this next comment to amuse you. Alas, I am not. This is what I actually said. Driving in cities is one of the few things my parents let me do, I said. I've even driven to D.C. a few times. There was another pause, as if she was waiting for me to say something else. I filled in the silence with, so what are you going to do instead? Nothing, I guess, she said softly. Sometimes I hear people say that if they could go back in time and relive their lives, they wouldn't change a thing. Obviously, these people have never had a conversation like this one. If only I had a time machine so I could go back to my younger self, slap him in the face, take the phone, and say, I apologize for this loser's utter stupidity. Hold on a second. Then I would put my hand over the mouthpiece, turn to my 16-year-old self, and say, dude, she wants you to give her a ride to D.C. But as of this writing, time machines haven't been invented yet. So this is how the conversation ended, in the timeline of past reality as it stands. My former self said he'd call her in the next day or two because we need to hang out again in the near future. And then he said goodbye and hung up. Even though I missed the chance to take her to D.C. for the concert, we did keep hanging out. And over the next few weeks, whenever we were playing pool in her basement, I would think about how much I wanted to kiss her. What I needed was the perfect date. As far as I could tell, the main things girls were looking for in a potential boyfriend were romance and danger. Romance because they grew up wanting to live in a fairy tale, to have some handsome prince rescue them and all that. Danger because, well, I'm not sure, but it seemed like girls always went for the bad boys, not the nice ones like me. So what I needed was an activity that combined these two pieces. What kind of date would have both romance and danger? One day, it just popped into my head. A picnic on top of a skyscraper. No, seriously, that was my plan. Francesca and I would lay down a blanket on the roof and eat up there in the clouds. She'd talk about how scared she was of heights and I'd make fun of her for it. Then we'd kiss right there on the edge of the skyscraper. Romance. Danger. Together. The two become one. Unfortunately, we didn't have any skyscrapers in Harrisonburg, but we did have an old office building on Court Square that was probably a good 20 stories tall. That would have to be it. I tracked down the owner, James McCone, at his jewelry store next door.
He was skinny and bald, perched on a plush antique chair as if it was a throne. "A picnic," he said thoughtfully, bringing his knees up to his chest and hugging them. "We might be able to do that. People are always trying to get up there. It's the best view in Harrisonburg, you know."
I thought so.
"But it's dangerous," he said cautiously.
"Exactly.
The problem is that when people go up there on the roof, their shoes get it all dirty." His ring-clad fingers twitched with the thought.
"We don't need to wear shoes," I offered. "We can go in socks."
He nodded. This seemed to be good news to him, so I continued.
"And we'll bring a blanket to sit on. It'll protect your roof."
"Will you be careful?" he asked.
"Yeah, we'll be careful."
He nodded.
"Okay, you got it."
"Thanks, James," I said, slapping him a high five.
"Uncle James," he corrected.
"Right. Thanks, Uncle James. And don't forget that when you're ready to get a ring for this girl, I'm going to come to my Uncle James, of course."
I called Francesca that night to tell her about the plan, hoping she'd be as excited about it as I was.
Chapter 15. "How was your day?" I asked. I was sitting on my parents' bed. We had two phones in our house, one in the kitchen and one in my parents' bedroom. When I wanted privacy, which is to say when I was talking to a girl I liked, I used the one in their bedroom.
"Okay," Francesca said over the phone.
"But I had to hang out with Andrew."
"Yikes."
"I just felt bad because I'd told him I was busy like 10 times in a row."
Andrew was this other kid from school. He'd been calling Francesca that summer too. Fortunately for me, Andrew didn't know the "we should hang out sometime" line, which would have stealthily evaded the "I'm too busy" excuses she usually gave him.
"So how was it?" I asked.
"Fine, I guess."
Suddenly, I felt a nearly overwhelming urge to ask questions about her date with Andrew. It was like a sneeze welling up inside my nose, desperate to blow its snot load all over the phone. And like a sneeze, I knew that this gossip session would feel oh so good. We would talk about whether Andrew liked her, whether she liked him, whether they'd make a cute couple. Achoo. Oh yeah. But I was smart enough by age 16 to steel myself against this urge with every bit of resistance power I could muster from my puritanical upbringing. Because to give into it would be to commit an unforgivable sin in Francesca's eyes. Talking about another guy she might be interested in would identify me as friend material. A nice guy. And the only time nice guys finish first is in a race to the friend zone. So even though I was super tempted to pursue a line of conversation about Francesca's date with Andrew, I overcame my game-killing instincts and changed the subject.
"Listen, I have something we should do together."
"What?"
"A picnic."
"Sounds fun."
"A picnic on top of a building."
"What?"
"On a building, like a picnic on a roof."
"What for?"
Not really the response I was hoping for.
"Because it will be awesome. We'll have a great view, there will be a nice breeze, it'll be something we can say we did."
She considered it.
"All right, I'm in."
"Yeah?"
"Sure."
I thought I heard her giggle.
"Okay, great, I've got it all set up."
"Sounds fun. I'm excited."
Excited? This date was getting better by the minute.
"Maybe next week?" Her voice dropped.
"Oh," she said.
"What?" I'm going on vacation next week.
How about the week after?
It's a 2-week vacation. I could do the week after that, though.
No, I'll be on vacation then, I said. And the next week I'm working at a camp.
And then school starts.
Bummer. After we said our goodbyes and hung up, I sat silently on my parents' bed for a while. I could already feel it. It was like when you're having a cool dream, like the one where you can fly, and it's everything you ever hoped it would be, but then you realize this is impossible, so it must be a dream, and you drop out of the sky and wake up. Once school started, I would be reminded of how popular she was, and how, according to the social order of things, I wasn't supposed to be cool enough to go out with her. I would lose my nerve.
Chapter 16. The next time I saw her or even talked to her was, indeed, a month later, the night before school started. We were at a punk rock show at the local VFW post. I would roll up to these shows with spiked hair and my totally punk rock necklace, a chain of marble-sized silver balls strung together that I owned solely for these occasions. I was what you'd call a poser. I wasn't even allowed to listen to the music at home. I just liked going to the shows to socialize and to mosh. After one particular song, I hopped out of the mosh pit, sweaty and out of breath, and when I picked up my crutches, I found Francesca was standing right there in front of me. She said something, but I couldn't make it out.
"What?"
I said. Again, she said something, but I couldn't understand it. The music was too loud. I pointed at my ears and then toward the door that led outside. We went out to the sidewalk. It was dark and humid, and the music pulsed on the other side of the door. We swapped summaries of our vacations, slipping back into an easy familiarity. I hadn't expected to see her tonight, but as we talked, the memories of the summer lit up in my mind, and the same rushing swirl of excitement and doubt flooded into my awareness. There were some kids making out in the bushes nearby. Should I kiss her? I wanted to. I didn't know if she would kiss back. But if she didn't, at least then I would know. I would know she didn't like me. I jingled my car keys in my hand, trying to fill a conversational void while I worked up the nerve. No, I couldn't do it. School was starting tomorrow. Summer was over. She was popular. I was not. Time to return to reality. "Well, I'm going home," I said. "Gotta get some sleep before first period tomorrow." "Okay," she said. We hugged. "Good to see you." When I got home, I went to the bathroom to brush my teeth. I looked in the mirror, but I couldn't make eye contact with myself. I had let myself down. Again. It was so stupid. Why couldn't I just step up and, I don't know, be brave or something? I was an embarrassment to myself, and it had to stop. It was time to take a risk. It was time to take action. I looked at myself in the mirror, set my jaw, and nodded. I got in my car and drove back to the concert. I slammed my car door and marched into the VFW post, waving my already stamped hand to the guy at the door as I entered. Another band was setting up on the far side of the room. Francesca was sitting against the wall talking to a friend. I was nervous, but I had to do this. Do what? I wasn't sure, but something had to happen, and it had to happen tonight. "I thought you left," she said when she noticed me standing in front of her. I hoped she had not also noticed that I was shaking from all the adrenaline. "I did." Francesca exchanged a look with her friend that I couldn't read. Then she looked back up at me. "Can I talk to you?" I asked.
"Sure."
"Outside?"
"Okay." We walked out the door, across the sidewalk, and to the parking lot, without saying anything. I sat down on one of those log-shaped cement parking stops. She followed suit, sitting right beside me.
I just wanted to say, I began.
What, exactly? What was I doing here? Was I trying to kiss her? Tell her something? I squeezed the top of the cement block so she wouldn't be able to see my hand shaking. I just wanted to say that I'm really glad I asked you to play golf at the start of the summer, I said.
Perfect. That was it. All I needed to do was say that, and now she would look at me and tell me she'd never met a guy like me before and she wanted to be with me forever and we'd kiss.
I'm so glad you did, she said.
And?
I waited for her to say how much she liked me, how she thought about me every waking moment of every day.
Yeah, I'm glad you did, she said.
Why wasn't this working? Why wasn't she trying to kiss me or something? Then I realized I myself hadn't really said anything yet. I hadn't made a move. This was all so much more difficult than I had imagined it would be back when I was brushing my teeth by myself in the safety of my home.
It's like, you're so cool, I said. I thought you were this person I could never talk to.
People always tell me stuff like that.
They do?
Yeah. I don't understand.
You're just, I don't know, you're...
There were so many options, so many ways to say what needed to be said, and they were all right there in front of me, on the tip of my tongue. But what came out was, you, and it's like, wow, I can't believe I'm talking to you right now. I was drowning. Drowning in a raging sea of feelings, coughing and sputtering out desperate, disjointed words while I struggled to keep my head above water. There was a life ring floating right in front of me. All I had to do was reach out and grab it. Tell her how I felt. The problem was, emotional beats rational. Fear trumps logic. Every time.
Okay, well, I guess I'll see you at school tomorrow, I said.
Not knowing what else to do, in the following weeks, I made the very strategic move of never calling her again. We didn't have any classes together fall of senior year, and when I'd pass her in the hallway, each of us exchanging a cheery greeting that ended in an exclamation mark, I'd tell myself that it didn't matter anyway. There was no way a girl like that would ever like a boy like me, right? Right? Whenever I saw her, I would think back to that night sitting in the parking lot during the concert and wonder, did I have a chance after all? Was there a possibility that maybe she liked me? Just a little bit? When we were sitting there on that rock, was she perhaps feeling a tiny flutter of hope that I would kiss her? If so, was she completely confused or even hurt at the end of the summer when I suddenly stopped calling her? Did she think that maybe I was not interested in her in that way, that maybe for some reason I actually wanted to stay in the friend zone? Did she wonder if she had done something wrong? Or maybe she didn't like me after all. Maybe the golf course prosthesis disaster scared her off. Maybe she kept seeing me after that because she was simply too nice to say no. At any rate, I graduated high school a semester early so I could pursue my dream of being a ski racer. It took a lot of convincing, but eventually my parents gave me permission to move out to Colorado in December and become a full-time athlete. Training every day on the mountain at Winter Park and traveling around the western United States and Canada for competitions. During the ski season, I didn't think much about girls.
All I thought about, really, was skiing. And by the time I came back to Harrisonburg at the end of the ski season, it was late March. It had been so long since I had talked to Francesca that I knew I'd never get another chance with her. Hypothesis. Subject behavior suggests Francesca may have had romantic attraction toward me, but due to my awkward behavior and fear-induced reluctance to initiate mouth-to-mouth contact, she lost interest over time. Investigation. Chapter 17. If I really want to find you on Facebook, no number of privacy settings is going to stop me. Footnote. Creepiest sentence in this entire audiobook? So it was with Francesca Marcello. It required a lot of searching and no finding, and then searching for her friends and friends of friends from high school, friending them, then scrolling through their friends for the Fs. Eventually, I found her. Francesca Marcello. I messaged her about, you know, hanging out sometime while we were both home for Christmas. She was game. That's how I found myself standing on her porch on December 26th, knocking on her front door and watching that stairway for her to come down, feeling much like I had a decade before when I'd come to pick her up for our golf course date. She appeared at the top of the stairway, and as she walked down, I reviewed the script I had created in my mind, the script for our conversation that would lead to all my questions being answered. But here's the problem with scripts. They work great in movies. In life, not so much. Life is too complicated. As soon as you involve other human beings and their unwieldy free wills, you can kiss your precious script goodbye. She opened the door. Her hair was cut pixie short, and her clothes were even more earthy and hempy than they were back in high school. For a second, I wasn't even sure it was her. But then I looked at those hazel eyes. Francesca Marcello, I said, smiling. Josh Sundquist. She wrapped her arms around my neck, and I put one forearm crutch-attached hand around her waist while I kept my weight on the other crutch for balance. Come on in. She led me downstairs to the basement to play a game of pool. I hoped, I wondered, if maybe she felt the same pent-up tension I did, the same lingering years-old interest that kept festering, kept saying, it's possible, we could be together. We should be together. I racked the balls and pushed them into the front of the triangle before lifting it away. I let her break. I didn't want to beat her too badly. Francesca and I caught up on biographical information. College, graduation, current employment status, and the like. She asked me about my job as a motivational speaker. Bingo. That was the opening line in my script. She was following it perfectly. You remember back the first time we ever hung out? I began. When my artificial leg malfunctioned on the golf course? She smiled. Yeah, I remember. I actually tell that story in my speeches. About me? Well, it's mostly about my leg, but yeah, it's about you too. I couldn't read her expression, couldn't determine whether she was pleased or dismayed with this revelation. I pressed forward, offering, people really like it. That's good, she said noncommittally. It was my turn in our game of pool, and I was lining up my shot. But I stood upright before taking it in order to pause the game while we proceeded into the dramatic climax of my script. In fact, I said, people always come up to me after my speeches and say, what happened to you and Francesca? and I'm never quite sure what to tell them. Here was the punchline. I looked straight across the pool table into her eyes to deliver it with maximum feeling. What happened to us, Francesca?
I don't know, she said. What did happen to us?
I froze. This was not part of the script. She was supposed to answer the question, not deflect it back to me. I wanted her to tell me exactly what went wrong, why she didn't like me, or to tell me that she did like me and for all these years she'd been wishing our hanging out had turned into an actual relationship. But instead of giving me an answer, she had turned the question around. That caught me off guard. I didn't have the answer. That's why I had asked her, after all. I felt like we'd gone back in time 10 years, returning to that golf course. I was falling in slow motion, down, 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 landing on my back beside the tee, the foot of my artificial leg turned at an anatomically impossible angle. I looked up at her in shock and confusion and embarrassment, for a moment frozen there on the grass, unsure of what to say next. That's how I felt again a decade later in her basement, caught in the headlights. She had asked me a question, but I was too scared to try to answer. Almost like I knew exactly what had happened to us, but was afraid to admit it to myself. I don't know, I said. She nodded slowly, almost sagely, and then she changed the subject, leaving me to wonder about that nod. Was she nodding to agree with the fact that I didn't know, as in, you certainly don't know, do you? You still don't get it, and you probably never will. Or was she nodding to show that she didn't know either? The nod was frustratingly ambiguous, but the message clear. This was a question I would somehow have to answer for myself. Evelyn Williamson. Background. Chapter 18. A neon yellow indoor soccer ball whizzed past my head. The ball hadn't been aimed at me, of course. Everyone could see I was standing on the sideline, deliberately sitting this one out, like I did most active games at youth group. Of course, it was my choice to wear my prosthesis. Without it, I could have hopped and participated. But I chose to wear it because the social aspect of youth group was more important than the dodgeball aspect, and I did better socially when I was wearing the leg. At least I had Evelyn to keep me company. Remember when you'd spend hours studying for the SATs every Saturday? She asked, granting me the dignity of ignoring the near miss with the soccer ball. After all, she knew how it felt to be left out. Yeah, every Saturday.
Were you doing practice tests?
Sometimes, or memorizing vocabulary flashcards. She tucked an errant strand of brown hair behind her ear. She looked over at me with her manga-sized eyes and her curled eyelashes. She had a tall, thin, boxy frame, so our eyes met at the same height. Have you ever thought about doing something, you know, fun with your weekends? First of all, that was last semester. I'm done with the SATs. Second of all, it was fun. It was spring semester, and I was back home after training in Colorado. I wasn't going to school, though, since I'd finished all my classes in December.
Studying SAT words? Fun?
Yes, it was ubiquitous fun. After I said it, I realized it was probably not the proper use of the word. Oh well.
Seriously?
Yeah, I enjoy standardized tests.
No, I mean, did you seriously just use an SAT word to describe how much fun you were having while studying for the SATs?
I did. Thank you for noticing. Joe Slater blew his whistle, and one of the dodgeball teams was declared victorious. You're so weird. Again, thank you. How many times did you end up taking the SATs?
6.
That's a lot.
Had fun every time.
Now that you're done, maybe you should call me more often.
Ah, there it was. The point of this conversation.
Maybe I will. She smiled and poked me with her finger. You should.
It annoyed me slightly when she flirted like this, because, in fact, I was in love with her. Or as close to love as you can be when you're 17 and a member of the opposite sex has become your quasi-best friend. Evelyn's flirting always made me wonder, what if we were more than best friends? What would that be like? But as I said, it was slightly annoying, too. This was because of Mason, her on-again, off-again boyfriend.
How are things with Mason?
I meant it partly as a reminder. This is why I don't call you more often. You have a boyfriend.
She sighed. We're taking a break. This sort of drama was nothing new.
You want to talk about it?
Talking about her boyfriend was, of course, a total friend zone move. But that's exactly what she and I were, friends.
She looked down at her feet. The balls were flying again. Another round had begun.
He was home from college this weekend.
Yeah.
But he said long distance was too hard.
And he wanted to take a break?
She nodded, her weight shifting on her closely watched feet.
That sucks, I offered.
Yeah, it sucks.
How long has it been since...
How long you been together?
This time?
She smirked and rolled her eyes.
6 months, I guess. Before that, it was a year.
That's a long time.
He's right, she said.
I mean, it is hard. Long distance, I mean. It's really hard.
But still...
But still, I echoed.
Like everyone in the history of the world who has had a crush on his or her best friend, I was too scared to tell her. Because if I did, I might lose her completely. And the sharp bite of losing her completely would be far worse than the one-sided romantic arrangement we had going.
Joe Slater blew a whistle, and the second game was over. We, the two disabled kids, joined the rest of the group. I had a choice about whether I wanted to wear my leg or not. Evelyn, though, she didn't have such a choice. Early in high school, she was a standout soccer star, a talented athlete with the gift of speed. But then she contracted early onset rheumatoid arthritis, and now her joints moved too stiffly for soccer. I guess she could have played dodgeball tonight if she had wanted to, but her knees would swell up painfully for several days afterward. So, instead, the two of us stood and watched from the sidelines. It was something we had never explicitly discussed, this thing we shared. I guess it was both too obvious to warrant discussion and too painful to justify it.
Chapter 19. In April of what would have been my senior year, I was, unfortunately, nominated for prom king. How did this happen since I wasn't even attending school and didn't exactly run with the cool crowd? I guess 4 years of saying hi to everyone in the hallway finally paid off. Why do I say unfortunately? I mean, for a lot of students, prom king or queen is the pinnacle of high school awesomeness, the greatest thing they could aspire to. But for me, not so much. Let me explain the way I looked at the situation. At my high school, 4 guys and 4 girls were nominated. Then there was a runoff vote with these 8 nominees, and on prom night before the dance started, they would all be called to the stage. One guy would be crowned prom king and 1 girl prom queen. And then the other 6 would walk off the stage in public humiliation, having just been declared not quite cool enough.
And since there were four male nominees, there was a 75% chance I would be one of the losers. Well, not really. Elections aren't determined by random probability. But since there were no pre-election polls in the race for prom king, let's assume for the sake of our discussion that my chances of winning were 1 in 4. Which aren't great odds, obviously. I mean, even when I had cancer, my chances were 50-50. And I recall being pretty worried about it at the time. And those odds were twice as high as my chances of winning prom king. So anyway, all this is why I considered my nomination to be unfortunate. On the other hand, there was always the outside chance I could win. And maybe the victory would catapult me into actually having fun at the dance. I could certainly use the boost. If there was one activity I felt insecure about as a result of having one leg, it was dancing. My first school dance had been homecoming, which my parents finally allowed me to attend in 10th grade. I remember standing on the edge of the makeshift dance floor in the cafeteria. I wanted so desperately to join the other students, to dance with abandon, to have fun and be fun, to break out of my shell and break it down on my prosthesis. But I couldn't do it. My body, and especially my titanium-constructed left leg, was simply too stiff. So in 11th grade, I volunteered to serve punch at the homecoming dance. I wanted to be there for social reasons, but I needed a plausible excuse to hang out at the punch bowl all evening. It worked pretty well. But then came senior year and the unfortunate prom king nomination, which made it sort of impossible to skip the dance. And it would be tough to serve punch if I ended up being crowned the winner. And this leads us to my most important problem. I had to find a date. Francesca already had one. Not that I would have had the guts to ask her anyway. And my go-to line, "we should hang out sometime," wasn't as smooth when it came to finding a prom date. A few nights later, I called Evelyn from the phone in my parents' bedroom. "Hello?" It was her family's landline, but I recognized her voice. "Hey, it's Josh. Do you yeah, I remember you, silly. I'm on the other line with Mason." "Oh, sorry. I can call back." "No, it's fine. We were just about to hang up. Hold on." The line went quiet for a moment. The fact she had been talking to Mason suggested several things, none of them good. "Josh?" "Yep." "Cool, what's up?" "Not much. You?" "Well, you know, just talking to Mason." "How did that go?" "He thinks he might have made a mistake by breaking up with me."
"Might have?"
"Yeah, but he's not sure yet."
"He's not sure?"
To me, it was obvious. Of course he had made a mistake. Who would ever dump Evelyn?
"Yeah, not sure." "What would make him sure?"
"Well, I mean, obviously we love each other, but long distance is hard, you know?"
I didn't know, actually. I had never had a girlfriend, much less a long-distance one, much less known what it was like to truly be in love with someone who loved me, too.
"Yeah, it sounds tough." "I just don't know, Josh. I feel like Mason and I go through this cycle again and again and again. I just can't seem to stop."
I sat down on the bed. "Well, they say that admitting you have a problem is the first step, so congrats on that."
"Thanks. What's the next step?"
"Dating me," I thought.
"I'm not sure."
To be fair, Mason was a really cool guy. And I mean cool in a genuine sense, not cool as in popular. I knew him pretty well, and when I was honest with myself, I had to admit that if I was a girl, I'd probably choose him over me too. I just didn't understand why he wouldn't choose Evelyn in return. I had this fantasy about Evelyn, but not the kind of fantasy you'd expect from a teenage boy. My fantasy went like this. My girlfriend, Evelyn, would call me one afternoon, crying about a terrible fight she'd had with her mom or a devastating test score or something.
In between sobs, she'd gasp out little sentences. She didn't know what to do. Her life was falling apart. Nothing made